Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Why, hello there. We're just having ourselves a little podcast. I'm Tender Grape Devourer, Lady P. No relation to Master P.
Allow me
to introduce our esteemed panel. First up, don't let the fabulous hair fool you. Our first guest is pure evil. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Kristen Sales.
Well, I do declare.
And currently collapsing at the foot of the stairs is Miss Amory Kelly.
I'll be waiting for you to die.
Yes. On today's show, we have another entry in our Betty Davis series. Dearest Anne is going to tell us why she thinks William Wyler's 1941 film, The Little Foxes, is one of the greatest films of all time. Anne, are you ready?
I am.
All right, let's do it. Tell us about Little Foxes.
All right, it's a 1941 film based on the Lillian Hellman play of the same name that had opened only shortly before the film did. Lillian Hellman, a playwright not exactly known for her subtlety, and so it is a movie and a script that is an archetypal story of the South during the Reconstruction. It takes place, I think, around the turn of the
1900
century, where the shadow of the Civil War looms large, but not in the kind of romantic way that it does in Gone with the Wind, necessarily. It's the story of a family, the Giddens family, who has decided to move a cotton mill, bring the factory to the cotton. But this is a decision, this is a business decision that could have long-lasting and terrible effects for the town. Despite this being about a business transaction, it's a very human story where you see three generations of the Giddens family arguing, bickering, and trying to decide the future of the town and, by extension, the future of the South. Mm-hmm. In many ways, I think of this as kind of the reply to the antebellum romanticism of Gone with the Wind. It tells a very different story of the South. That said, this does need to be said. It's a very racist movie. It's a very racist story. It still has Mammy character. Her name is Addie. It still has ornamental blackness and all of the kind of awful things that you associate with studio system movies about the South. But the decision to cast at the time 33-year-old Betty Davis as family matriarch Regina Giddens has the result of putting this movie in conversation with arguably one of Betty Davis's most famous films, Jezebel, which is a movie in the glowing antebellum tradition of Gone with the Wind, arguably even more glowing and sweet towards the South than Gone with the Wind was. And it makes for a very fascinating, complicated, and at times terrifying exploration of how easily people devalue each other's humanity. So it's directed by William Wyler. It's another Wyler and Betty Davis collaboration. Of particular note, which I think we're all going to be talking about, the cinematography is by Greg Toland, the famous cinematographer who introduced deep focus to Citizen Kane. He didn't create deep focus, but he is probably best known for using it. And I would argue that it is used as well in this film as it is in Citizen Kane. Ultimately, I think this is a movie that goes beyond just Betty Davis's performance, although hers looms large over the rest of the film.
Okay. All right. I like it. Kristen, thoughts on Little Foxes?
Well, I hadn't seen this film before. I watched it for this Betty Davis series, and I'm glad I did. I was, because I had seen Jezebel before, and I was a little bit wary that that film was a little too arch for me, maybe. I don't know. There was a lot of posturing and a lot of southernness, and usually these sort of like a wilting Southern dynasty type films don't appeal to me for manifold reasons. But this one, I think partly because of the photography, this is the third film that Greg Toland shot in 1941, the other ones being Citizen Kane and Ball of Fire, which is like, whew.
He had a good year.
Talk about, that's a real strong filmography right there. So I was glad to see it for that, and I think that Anne's dead on. It's a stage play, so it's always a real struggle to bring a stage play to the cinematic realm, especially one like this where it's just people talking in rooms. The deep focus does it brings a whole level of intrigue of shadow and of sort of duplicitousness that shades the characters and their actions. And I think Bette Davis in this is totally laser focused and extremely commanding and scary. She is a matriarch, and that's clear from the first time that you see her, that this house and this family is her domain. So I really loved the movie.
All right.
I did.
Okay.
I wouldn't count myself as a Wilder fan in general.
Okay.
But I think that this film is really, really notable.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I guess my experience with the film, I'd seen it years ago when I was just digging into my Bette Davis phase. Like, there was a point in my life where I was just all about Bette Davis. And honestly, this film didn't stand out to me all that much. So when Anne suggested this as being one of her best films, I was like, okay, I'm willing to consider that. And I don't know that it's necessarily one of my personal favorites, just because it's kind of an unpleasant environment to be in for 2+ hours, I think. Mm-hmm. And also there just isn't enough Bette Davis. I do think that it is notable in that it is, I think, her best collaboration with William Wyler, who is the director she's most associated with. And it is, you're right that it is, it manages to be cinematic despite being essentially a film play. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And the performance, there's something so different about this portrayal as opposed to, like you said, Jezebel, or just really any of her other roles, where she is often played villainesses. Like, I think of Human Bondage. Like, she's monstrous. But here, she's so understated, which is not something I usually associate with Bette Davis. But she is kind of just so stoically evil. And I loved watching her play this role. Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, some of the weaknesses for me are in some of the other performances. But, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so that goes into why I chose this, because this isn't one of the iconic Bette Davis roles. Usually, if you're doing like your TCM retrospective on Bette Davis, it will start with the big ones, Now Voyager, Dark Victory, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, All About Eve, and then like near the end, probably right around one of the two times she played Queen Elizabeth, you'll get a quick shot of her as Regina. Mm-hmm. But that's actually the reason that I chose it. I think it stands in conversation with a lot of her other performances, especially, like I said before, one of her most iconic ones, Jezebel. And I think that it's an example of, as in Bette Davis's career specifically, and it's an example of what she and Wyler did together best. Because as we talked about in the All About Eve performance, Bette Davis can go very broad, and it is really fun to watch. But what she does with Wyler so well, which Sales touched on, is like bring it down to laser focus. Wyler, I wouldn't say corrals her, but focuses all of that energy in a direction. Mm. And what I love about Regina, what terrifies me about Regina, is that she starts the play knowing exactly what she wants, and she does not stop until she gets there. And watching the full brunt of Bette Davis's energy go towards one goal is fascinating. Now, as that's happening, there are a lot of different hoops that she needs to cover. And that kind of very domineering matriarchal facade, that white makeup that William Wyler actually referred to as the kabuki makeup, starts to kind of show cracks, and you start getting the sense of the person underneath, not just in the long expository monologues that she gets about what she wishes she had, but in quieter, softer moments too. So that what you're left with is, yes, this arch villainess, but with subtle underpinnings of the person that made the decisions to be this villainous character. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I really enjoy about the movie in terms of Bette Davis. There's also just a lot of other things going on in this movie because it is one of those, like, plays about America. So it's got your Southern... It does have your wilting Southern Belle in the character of... Oops, I forgot her name.
It's Birdie.
Birdie. Thank you.
Which I get confused because there's a Birdie in all of Eddie.
Yeah, I know, right? yeah, so it does have the wilting Southern Belle in the character of Birdie, but she is, if a sympathetic character, also a very pathetic character. Mm. Puts the pathetic and sympathetic. Mm-hmm. And you've got your carpetbagger family, like, kind of preying off of the once noble Southern heritage. Mm. But I don't think there are really even any easy answers in that, because the quote-unquote moral heart of the story is the banker, Regina's husband, who is against the business proposition that she is putting forward. And so the last third of the movie is really just her fighting with her husband, who has a weak heart condition, because why not throw a little extra symbolism in? Again, like I said before, Lillian Hellman is many things, but subtle is rarely one of them.
Subtlety is overrated.
Yeah. And this is a movie that is equal parts theatrical and cinematic in all that the two things imply. I think the use of deep focus allows for some really fascinating staging moments. Like Sales, I'm not a huge Wyler fan, but in this movie, I think he positions people in the frame a lot like John Ford does when John Ford uses deep focus, so that you get these tableaus of characters who aren't supposed to be listening in, who are listening in, threats that are really only shown through, like, a person's feet appearing in the back of the frame. Who is listening in the background is as important as who's talking in the foreground. And so it is one of the best, like, examples of how to fill a frame that is that deep, that is then contrasted by the biggest moment in the film happening in shallow focus, which I think we can talk about later.
Yeah.
One of the most iconic scenes on a stairwell, I think. Possibly.
There are lots of good stairwell scenes.
There are a lot of
foxes. I mean, it's the centerpiece of the stage, which is their home. But yeah, it's good. I mean, I think Wyler shoots things like Ford because of his collaboration with Tolan. Because in the year previously, he shot Grapes of Wrath, which is also a large ensemble piece with a lot of people, and The Long Voyage Home, which is the same thing. You got a lot of people on the same boats. I think maybe there came a point in the late 30s and early 40s where people were able to, through the use of technology, where people were able to pack a lot of people in the same frame and sort of spin a lot of plates at once. And you're getting, I think this is just coming across at the right time where you're finally making, you know, a stage play something that is sort of multidimensional and something that you can really capture the attention of everyone in the same shot. You don't need to move the camera to see everybody at once. That's...
Let's talk a little bit more about William Wyler as a director. You both kind of expressed some, I don't know, maybe you're not quite so hot on him as a Hollywood auteur, and I don't know if his reputation has diminished because he was kind of rejected by the Cahiers du Cinéma crowd or whatever. I hate to think they have that much influence, but...
they do.
Yeah.
I think that actually, that probably is one contributing factor. To me, it's just he's never the guy that comes to mind first or even tenth when I'm thinking of classical Hollywood cinema. Although you look at didn't he win the most director Oscars of anybody in history nominated? And you look at his filmography and there's a ton of great movies in there. It's just there's something that's relatively, and I don't want to say anonymous, but there's nothing really in the Wyler that sticks as much as a Capra Ford, you know, name your classical hawks, anybody like that. that is sort of as memorable. But I mean, I think it depends on the material, and I think it depends on his collaborators. Mm-hmm. And he has two really, really excellent collaborators in this movie, and it's a great movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When and if you subscribe to the Cahiers de Cinéma idea of what makes an auteur director is one who needs to have a specific signature. And like Sales said, he's a little bit more like Howard Hawks, where he can mold himself very well to the film, what the film requires. So he's the guy who did Ben-Hur.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not Charlton Heston. And that's a completely different movie visually, thematically. Like, you wouldn't look at that and look at Little Foxes and go, oh yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Like, I can see from point A to point B.
And Children's Hour and Roman Holiday. Yeah. I mean,
and
it's
Funny
like,
Girl.
Yeah, I know. There's, he is just kind of like a metteur en scène.
Actually, what I think is kind of fascinating about that is, like, as much as Wyler is overlooked by kind of the auteur theory subscribers, this movie, Little Foxes, is one of the movies that André Bazin kept going back to when he was developing his concept of realism, which is a not fully formed idea as much as it has influenced the, like, idea of what realism means in cinema, entirely because of Greg Toland's cinematography and the use of deep focus. So even though the director himself is not particularly lauded by the French critics, the film is. And I think that also might contribute in part to why it doesn't end up in the Bette Davis conversation as much, is because when you take that very technical, well, this is what realism means in this context, and this is how it's shown in this movie, which I also think is a kind of weird thing because it's actually a very theatrical movie in performance and mm-hmm. staging. You lose sight of like the actors and actresses in it. That's taking a much more theoretical approach as opposed to an actorly approach. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It just influences how the film is seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to go ahead and champion William Wyler, just because he did make so many great movies. I'm not sure, maybe he didn't put his own stamp on it, or maybe there's just too many disparate things in his filmography. But I think if Ben-Hur weren't in there, it would all make a lot more sense. Like, that's like such an outlier, and it's such a... I'm not a fan of that movie.
Great action scenes.
That is true. That is true. But again, like, that's, again, not really his strong suit, generally. So it's just a very strange movie. Anyway, but yeah, so it's kind of, this Little Foxes is kind of like it doesn't fit into any neat kind of theoretical, there's nothing really that anyone can grab onto. Like, it's not maybe like the best showcase for Bette Davis, even though she's fantastic.
Yeah, it kind of gets overshadowed. It's not the best of anyone's output.
Yeah. Yeah, like Citizen Kane. Greg Toland made Citizen Kane that year. You're going to talk about Citizen Kane.
It's kind of like everyone's getting overshadowed.
Yeah.
And like you said, you say that Bette Davis isn't in it enough, which I sort of understand. She does. She's just sort of like the thread that it's like her influence mm-hmm. throughout the film more than her actual physical presence,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, why I like the film, because it's so... the intimation of her is as scary as whenever she shows up. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There's Bette Davis movies where there's more Bette Davis. There's Greg Toland movies where there's more Greg Toland. Mm-hmm. And there's you know, and the Wyler movies, I think...
there are others that won more Academy Awards.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. There's this is kind of a awkward stepchild for all those people.
But
it's good. We're here to champion.
Yes, so. We are. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe we should talk about some of the other performances.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so it's not... While there isn't quite as much Betty as I would have liked, there are some other standout performances.
It should be noted that it was nominated for a lot of Acting Academy Awards, mm-hmm. including Bette Davis.
Mm-hmm.
It went home completely empty-handed. It was nominated for 9 Oscars. I don't think it won any.
Again, tough year.
Yeah, tough year.
Yeah.
But it was one of the things that was nominated, two of the things it was nominated for, Best Supporting Actress for both Teresa Wright playing the daughter,
mm-hmm.
Bette Davis's daughter, and Patricia Collins playing Birdie.
Mm-hmm. And they're both excellent. Yeah.
And they're both excellent for exactly what they're supposed to be. Teresa Wright being the kind of character whose moral growth kind of directs the, for lack of a better term, she is the audience supplement. She's mm-hmm. the person to whom things are explained. This is why this moment is important. Mm-hmm. Sit down, young lady,
right.
Let me tell
she's
you about...
Just, she's discovering the awful skeletons in her family's closet,
exactly.
along with the rest of us.
And Birdie, as previously mentioned, acting as the symbol of the the now degraded Southern aristocracy who may or may not have deserved it. I mean, there is that kind of phenomenal moment in it where they talk about slave ownership and she like breaks and be like, we treated them great. Like, that's not an excuse.
Right, with their housekeeper sort of in the background.
Yeah.
Although there is a great take. Now, I don't know the actress's name, but there is a great, because of that, you get that deep focus photography, especially in that scene where they're sitting out in the patio or whatever, and that conversation comes up, and Birdie is already so pathetic, and she's so quick to sort of, because what she wants, the only thing she wants in the play is to get her that plantation back.
Mm-hmm.
But when she talks about the housekeeper who's in the back pouring the lemonade or whatever,
Addie,
she does a great double take when you hear that. And you get to see that because you see everybody staggered in the frame. And I think it's so much more interesting the way that they were able to capture all that visually than a lot of the other sort of Southern aristocracy movies that we've been talking mm-hmm. about, where usually you cut to somebody and they have some sort of stereotypical quip or something that, you know, you would expect sort of these stereotyped characters to say or to do. And I think there's a little bit more subtlety, if only in the way that everybody shares the same frame.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually what Bazin was talking about when he incorporated this into his concept of realism, is the fact that you don't have to cut away to reaction shots because the reactions are playing out mm-hmm. in the middle. Yeah. Addie is an undersung hero, considering
certainly
how little she's actually given to say beyond the usual stupid mammy comments.
Right, of course.
But it's I like the juxtaposition between Birdie and Regina. I would like to say the play's being revived this year with Cynthia Nixon and Laura Linney.
Nice.
And they are going to be switching off who plays Birdie and who plays Regina, just in case that whole, like, shadow, one's the shadow of the other doesn't really play out in the movie. Yeah. Now it's, like, very obvious because they're going to be switching. And I think Dorothy Collins does an amazing job with this role that really is only there to kind of, like, that's really only there to kind of contextualize and give reactions. You need to know how horrible what this family is doing. And so they have basically two characters who are victims who pop up every once in a while to cry, this is horrible. Right. Considering that's really her thematic purpose, she does a lot with it.
Mm-hmm.
Giving Birdie not just a level of patheticness, but also like that kind of hopefulness, fear. She plays a lot of notes, considering that her character is really only supposed to be one thing.
Mm-hmm. Right, because all the other characters are jockeying for positions of power, and they all are various shades of ambitious. It mm-hmm. takes a lot of strength to play someone that's that weak
mm-hmm.
In the film, which is, you know, why, you know, because Teresa Wright has that sort of, like, innocence thing, which is not a weakness in and of itself, but she just has a naivete, and everyone else is just, you know, conniving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about how the Betty Davis character and the Birdie character kind of mirror images of themselves, of each other.
Mm-hmm.
What do they have in common, first of all?
Mm-hmm.
And where do they diverge? They're women. Yeah. I mean, they've both essentially been constricted to certain roles, and mm-hmm. one has taken a more proactive path, and
right,
the other
and
is kind
they're
of
both trying to navigate their own advancement vis-a-vis their husbands
mm-hmm. and
their
both,
marriages.
Yeah, their marriages, and both married with an expectation that then was not fulfilled.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Dorothy. Sorry, the actress's name is Dorothy. Birdie married. What's it? Oh gosh, what's his name?
Mustache. Dude.
Mustache. I was just going to say, Mr. Mustache.
Ben. Birdie married Ben because Ben wooed her and she thought that, like, that he actually loved her, and then it turns out he was marrying her for the cotton.
Yeah.
Regina married Horace.
Yeah.
Regina married Horace out because he loved her and she thought he could get her somewhere that he mm-hmm. then did not want to get to her. So yeah, so they do stand in opposition to each other. I mean, also Birdie comes from a position of wealth, and obviously Regina is fighting from the bottom to get to the top. Mm-hmm. So they're like passing each other in terms of who's got power in the situation and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also framed very often as if they're kind of shadows of each other. So very often when Regina is in the front of the frame arguing for her position and jockeying for position, Birdie's in the background listening. There's actually this wonderful shot where if you look right to left, you've got Regina, brother, keeping going backwards. Birdie is in the very background, sitting down, listening, and just, like, entirely wrapped up in her own world. And then another brother, so that you've got this triangle, which is then shown later, except it goes the same thing. It goes Regina, brother, and then in the way background is her daughter, is Teresa Wright's character, Zan, listening in, taking the Birdie role, because this is a point when she's still very subservient and passive, and then another character. So that triangle, the triangle of power, gets used a lot as a kind of visual motif.
Mm-hmm. What is the, I think, Alexandra character? Is it kind of like a battle for the Alexandra character's soul? Like, will she end up becoming more like Birdie? Will she end up becoming more like the Regina, or does she go and forge her own path? I wonder what her kind of career arc, or not her story arc is, and how optimistic are we feeling about her, the promise of her romantic or professional future?
I think she occupies two roles in the film. I think she is partially an audience substitute. Like I said before, somebody stands there and goes, Zan, this is why this next scene is going to be important. You might want to listen in. And she is kind of the moral center of the film, so that her journey from passive observer who doesn't see the skeletons in her family's closet to actively saying, no, that I am not going to participate in this kind of stripping away of all that is good and pure and holy in the South, going back to that Southern image a little bit, is kind of the moral arc of the film, of whether she's going to decide to be complicit in this, you know, terrible deal or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're meant to kind of follow her as the moral center, especially after Horace meets his untimely demise. Maybe a little bit timely.
Seems pretty timely to me. Time's up.
Yeah. I don't know. I again find myself feeling sympathy for some of the more reviled characters, especially Betty Davis's character, because it seemed like her options are so limited, and the play makes a point of saying so.
Of course, she's doing what she has to do.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. She has no leverage, and this is the only leverage she has.
Yeah.
Considering she starts from arguing of a place of no leverage, she like cleans up. Mm-hmm. She really knows how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's so great. It's like watching somebody play like the best game of Monopoly of all time. You know, but when they started, you know, with like the weakest real estate, it's really satisfying just in terms of to see, you know, you can't see her playing chess, but you can see the moves, and it gets really good in the end. Yeah.
Incidentally, Monopoly, also a game all about like capitalism over humanity.
Mm-hmm. No, and that's what makes this movie so quote unquote American. Mm-hmm. Not only is it about family, but it's about capitalism. So those are the two sort of things that all great American movies are about.
Yeah. Capitalism in the domestic sphere. It really hits all things. It's like Dallas before Dallas.
Yeah.
Actually, it really is Dallas before Dallas.
Yeah, well, on that note, maybe are there any other films that we want to compare to? I know we talked about Jezebel, but as far as just this time period and the kind of turn of the century America, this film came out in 1941, right?
Mm-hmm.
A few years later, we get The Magnificent Ambersons, right? Mm-hmm. Which, not actually shot by Greg Toland, but a clear influence there.
Yeah.
But it's both, while The Magnificent Ambersons takes place in Indiana, so it's kind of a Midwestern story as opposed to the Southern Reconstruction era tale. I'm wondering, like, during the mid-40s, can we maybe put this in historical context and why there was so much interest in this sort of transitory period of American history, and why it was just like, this is that time period, this, they had fun costumes, let's do that. Or was there maybe more going on, or just kind of like skepticism about American business? I don't know.
That's a big question.
I know.
Well, I think Reconstruction era stories about the South are p- peculiarly American stories. I think part of the reason that Gone with the Wind endured as long as it did, and part of the reason why so many movies that take place right after the Civil War kind of endure the way that they do, is because it is a moment when you have all of the different parts of the American myth kind of smashing into each other, all of those different contradictions kind of smashing into each other. Because we are talking about how this is about, you know, bettering oneself through capitalism, but that actually means, like, you know, paying less than minimum wage and kind of screwing over an entire town. Mm. So that, like, the carpetbaggers aren't the good guys. They never are the good guys, but, I mean, they're not even the good guys in Gone with the Wind. Like, it's considered one of the more terrible but wonderful moments when Scarlett O'Hara aligns herself with the carpetbaggers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this shot to the Southern aristocracy.
Yeah.
But at the same time is how she gets forward. So it's kind of her, like, anti-hero moment. So it is this odd thing of, like, these people who are American capitalists. So in that way, they should be, like, the ultimate example of the American dream are actually the bad guys. Mm-hmm. Because it shows the kind of greasy underbelly to the American dream in this context, which is sometimes to get ahead, the idea is that you're pushing down everybody else around you.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes place in such a specifically American context, which is the American South.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's kind of a battleground of different American ideals at the time.
So in that sense, it's less like Magnificent Ambersons and more like Citizen Kane, in that the pursuit of money and fame and just generally capitalism will leave individuals isolated and alone and miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I feel like this is sort of the Citizen Kane, that was a lone figure and he remained a lone figure.
True.
And in this one, it's clearly that it's a family that whose ties were not strong. They just, you know, like the good wasps they are, they didn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and then something came up and divided the family. I think of this movie as sort of like the dark side of, like, Meet Me in St. Louis.
No.
We're talking about that sort of era, that sort of early 1900s era. Mm-hmm. And St. Louis is not the South per se, but I feel like...
It's close enough.
I think stories like this about Southern families, they have to be Southern because Southern people have big families as opposed to Yankees who are, you know, very stodgy, 1.5 children, it necessitates a lot of roles for your contract players. You know, the kid down the street gets a role, and you get to have 5 or 6 or 7 kids. You get to have a costume picture, but without a lot of large action set pieces. So you kind of get to put a lot of the Hollywood studio mechanisms into play while keeping an intimate story. And then also there are there's a lot of source material about this era. There are a lot of novels, there are a lot of plays. I feel like Southern tragedy is kind of almost a fetishized narrative in American culture at large, because it's the worst time any white person ever had. That's Civil War. What a bummer for white people.
Snap sales, major snaps.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that's why there's so much material on it, and that it was fertile material for the classical Hollywood era.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I think Gone with the Wind, nothing talks like money, and mm-hmm. that made so much money. It gave a blank check, basically, to do any sort of story that resembled it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's also, when you pointed out the similarity to Meet Me in St. Louis, you blew my mind slightly, but you brought up a good point, which is that this is, like, as much as anything, these movies collectively are about a major paradigm shift in American economy,
mm-hmm.
and therefore American homes.
Right.
Made during a time that was another American paradigm shift in economy and homes. Like, all of these Reconstruction stories or these turn-of-the-century stories are when not just the northeast of the country was getting factories and industrialization and having more of its population moving into cities, but the rest of the country was too. Because that progress was a little bit slower to hit the rest of the country.
Right, we're talking about two wartime eras.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in the South especially, the, like, for white people, the tragedy of that really hit home for the first time.
Right, the death of their agrarian economy, and then they had to shift too.
Mm-hmm. Which left an entire population that had previously been on the top suddenly, the birdies of the world suddenly mm-hmm. on the bottom, where they'd never been before, because the American dream for so long had been buy land, build a farm, not enter a factory, rise to the top of it. So it's a complete shift. And then, like, another wartime economy where we went from being merely factory labor to, like, the biggest economy in the world. So, mm-hmm. and 41 and 44, we weren't there yet, but, like...
No, but you get, like, all of the cultural shift, the start of the gender shift, mm-hmm. the different roles, and sort of the disintegration or the shifting in families mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, so all of the crises of economy always hit the domestic sphere.
Right.
And so that's really what we're seeing is the intersection between those two places and the anxieties that are that result from it.
Mm-hmm. All right, well,
we didn't even talk about Betty Davis She's awesome.
Betty Davis is like Betty Davis. That's what the ascendancy of women in the domestic sphere during World War II. That's Betty Davis.
That's her jam.
That's her jam. Her thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You needed fierce bitches for that, you know, 4-year time period. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we always need them, but we agreed to need them.
Mm-hmm. Anything else we want to add before I ask the last question?
Do you want to talk about the reveal that Shalafu?
Oh my god, yes I do. Okay. So I talked about before that it's one of the most, that I think this movie has one of the most iconic staircase scenes up there with Olivia de Havilland at the end of The Heiress and,
Notorious.
And Notorious and Cagney at the end of Yankee Doodle Dandy in the opposite direction. but what's, so, spoiler alert, I hate this. So, the final scene between Horace and Regina, where they're battling it out, and then his heart murmur kicks in a major way, and he promptly dies, conveniently for her, is kind of a phenomenal scene in how it's shot, because it's the only obviously shallow focus scene in the entire movie, and so you don't see Horace die on the stairs in the same kind of clarity that you've seen the stairs for the rest of the movie. You really only see Regina's face. There was a reason for that was purely production oriented, which is that the actor Herbert Marshall, who plays Horace, had lost his leg. And so he couldn't climb up the stairs by himself?
No, it's not that he couldn't find it. He lost it in the war.
Yeah. He lost it in the war.
For the clarification. Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure that...
I'm sorry. He lost his leg in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so he couldn't climb up the stairs himself. So on a practical level, they just had to have a stunt guy in, and it was going to be very obvious in that crystal clear deep focus if it was a stunt guy mm-hmm. and not Marshall himself. However, the other result of staying only on Regina as he drags himself up the staircase and collapses is that this moment of almost inactivity of Regina just like sitting there staring, listening for his collapse, becomes a moment of activity. It becomes Electra at the doorway cheering on the death of Clytemnestra. Like it becomes a moment of active murder where it would have otherwise just read as passive.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like she's willing him to die, which she's really been doing the entire movie. She says, "I'm waiting for you to die." And right before he dies, she says, "I'm lucky, Horace. I've always been lucky. I'll be lucky again."
Yeah.
But it becomes entirely about her and entirely about her reaction. And Betty Davis plays it so well that not only do you see like the hope and anxiousness, you see the fear in her eyes. There is a lot going on for her in those like 15 steps that he takes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really the centerpiece of the movie. And if I have any misgivings about the movie, it's that the best, like I was waiting for something like that to happen the entire time. Give me that scene. You know what I mean? That's kind of my thought about it. Like, there are some...
You wanted more All About You.
I wanted more All About You. That's, you know, that's me. But not even because it's so subtle. You're right. It's just her face.
Mm-hmm.
And she conveys so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, with that horrible makeup and she's lit so blindingly mm-hmm. white during that scene. It's, I mean, that that white makeup is going to lead us into our next film, I think, in the Betty Davis trio. But it is sort of that monstrous, otherworldly, grotesque, especially in that shot. She doesn't look particularly odd or disturbing for most of that movie, but the way she's lit in that one scene where it's like, this is like super villain.
Yeah, hints of things to come.
Absolutely.
All right, well, on that note, Flixwise favorites. Is it in? What do you think?
Yep.
All right. It's in. There you go. And that's the way we frame it, Flixwise. That is, listeners, care to weigh in on whether or not the Little Foxes should be included on the Flixwise favorites list? Come leave us a comment on our website, flixwise.com. And you should also like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/flixwise. And if you just want to talk to me about other Wilder movies, I'd love to chat, or other Betty Davis movies, you can come find me on Twitter. The handle is at FlixWise. But before you do all of that, please make sure you go to iTunes or Stitcher or your preferred pod player and rate us and leave us a nice comment. Don't just stand by and let the big fat cats at Panoply and NPR eat up all the grapes. Support your local podcaster. Anyway, on our next show, it's my turn to propose a Betty Davis film for the Flixwise favorites list. It shouldn't come as any surprise that I'm going with Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, so get ready for a death match for the ages. Until then, and thank you so much for presenting The Little Foxes for entry.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, indeed, Kristen, rocking it, per usual.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, yeah. We need more Southern expressions.
Oh,
tomorrow is another day.
Oh, no.
Wrong movie.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all. Little foxes,
on the hillside, on the ticky-tacky with little foxes, made of it.